So welcome to the latest episode of Minorities in Publishing. If you follow the podcast, we're on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And yeah, you know, by the time this episode airs, it'll be the year mark for the podcast. And so I think it's so fitting to have such an established, award-winning, supportive, activist, fantastic writer like Tanana Reeve Due on. You are on the year anniversary episode, Tanana Reeve. Welcome.
Well, very exciting, and congratulations to you on your anniversary.
Thank you. And I mean, I was excited to be approached by your publicist to be on the podcast, and it's in that A, to talk to you, and B, that you have new work coming out. And C, to be able to tell you, My Soul to Keep is a book that's my introduction to your work, My Soul to Keep. And
right.
I think when people think speculative, I think people don't always understand the speculative realm of writing. That, you know, people say, oh, it's light sci-fi fantasy, or there are just so many different ways to describe sci-fi fantasy, speculative fiction. And
true.
Do you consider yourself a speculative writer or really writer?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I guess I've always thought of myself as a writer first, mm-hmm. because when I started writing, and I mean as a child, I did not have a category for myself. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even thinking of myself as a black writer. I was just writing, you know, I was mm-hmm. a writer. And of course, as you publish, the categories are laid upon you.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thrilled and excited to have found an audience of black readers. And early in my career, I thought it was limiting. It's like, well, you know, oh, all my signings are at black bookstores. Why don't we do more sort of Barnes & Noble? And then I learned very quickly, and I wish we had those black bookstores still. You know, it's been sad that we've lost so many.
I know.
Because I didn't understand that your publisher sends you where you will be the most readily embraced. And I think Samuel Delaney said something similar in his recent interview in The New Yorker. You know, mm-hmm. you're a part of the genre that accepts you.
That's true.
So I consider my work primarily to be supernatural. Often it's supernatural suspense, mm-hmm. although I do write some science fiction, maybe some magical realism.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are under the umbrella of speculative fiction, mm-hmm. although it really depends on the ear of the beholder. You know, what do you think speculative mm-hmm. fiction is? Mm-hmm. If speculative fiction feels more like sort of light sci-fi to you, than the actual definition of speculative fiction, which is an umbrella term
yes.
for all of these fictions, you know, that are not based out of contemporary realism, things that pretty much can't happen, you know, mm-hmm. for the most part. Except some people would argue with you in the world of magical realism, because those stories spring from traditions where people do believe that these things happen, or at least some version of these things happen. But primarily you're talking about, you know, monsters, aliens, space travel, time travel,
mm-hmm.
All these things that are not based in our world as we know it.
Yeah. So tying into that, how have the stories, be they written or oral, because a lot of people say, you know, especially the African-American, you know, narratives tend to be very oral in nature because of our history and ties to, you know, the colonization of America. So how have those stories played a part in your path to becoming a writer? And when did you know that you had something to say?
That's a great question. I grew up with a couple of oral storytellers, both of my parents, especially, I would say, my mother. My father was more one to scribble on his legal pads, sort of in alone. But mm-hmm. my mother was really almost single-handedly trying to keep the stories alive of her experiences, especially in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, mm. her fights with discrimination, how, you know, they were turned away when they tried to get ice cream when they were kids, how she started a petition when she was in high school to get rid of her principal, to try to get ready for this integration she thought would appear after the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education decision, and she still managed to graduate from an all-segregated school. She really thought it would be instant change, but she really was a keeper of sort of these flames, these stories, all these people she knew, black and white, who sacrificed their health,
mm-hmm.
some of them their lives, to give us, she was really always trying to contextualize what we had, where we were, how much was left to do. So my mother really, I guess, was the first storyteller in my life, although my father was also a storyteller. He told us a great empowering story about a group of black settlers fighting back against whites who attacked them when they were farmers in the 1800s and this sort of thing. So I come from storytellers, mm-hmm. and I started writing stories as young as four. You know, Baby Bobby, that was my first bestseller. No, it was a household hit. Just folding the typing paper in half, mm-hmm. drawing the little stick figures and giving them captions. And in terms of having something to say, really sort of finding my voice and power, I would have to say that was in a nonfiction piece. I was about 14 in 1980 when there was a terrible riot in Miami after a police killing. Several police officers killed a motorcyclist, tried to cover it up. They were acquitted. There was a riot. We've heard this story again and again and again, but this was my first up-close experience with it, and I was so torn up about it that I wrote what I called a poem. It turned into an essay about sort of this utopian society I wanted to live in, and it really felt like it saved my life in some ways. And my mother said, you know, you're very lucky that you have writing, because that's why you're not out there burning. You have a place to put your frustration. And that was when I sort of really understood the impact of writing as a healing mechanism. And I use storytelling to try to heal, like to heal history, to rewrite things, to give light to things that have been in darkness, to give voice to the chaos that we all feel as humans, not just as blacks. So yeah, I discovered my voice probably about the time I was 14.
So when saying that writing has helped save your life at that period, do you feel that currently social media is helping people to be able to vent their frustrations and find communities to discuss this with now?
Absolutely. I could not be more excited about social media. There's research that Pew did a couple of years ago, the Pew Research Center, on Twitter use. And blacks disproportionately use Twitter every day and tweet more than once a day, you know, according to our population. We are disproportionately represented. And the reason I think that is sort of the effect of a drumbeat being heard over miles. You know, before you had instant communication, the drum was the way you spread news. And Twitter, I think, really has become our drum, not just in the black community, but I would say in particular in the black community. A great example is this thread that just came out yesterday, if Hogwarts wasn't an HBCU, and it's a hashtag. And there were all these great comparisons, like Samuel L. Jackson would be teaching this class, and Erykah Badu would be teaching herbology, and all this kind of stuff, which was really a celebration of black nerdhood. You know, everyone who grew up with Harry Potter found family just over jokes about that. But that's, you know, that's just one use of it. Of course, in terms of its more powerful social justice reach, we started to see it with Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown about a year ago. And, you know, the case goes on and on and on. Eric Garner and Sandra Bland. And it has not only real world impact in terms of making things happen, but like you said, that notion of community, we used to just sort of sit with our circle of small friends and family and just stew in all these emotions. And now we can vent these emotions and share these emotions and get the message out and grow with each other and mourn with each other and celebrate with each other when it's time to celebrate and cry with each other when it's time to cry. Yeah. And it's really added a whole new personal dimension to the diaspora of all of us. You know, we're just spread out. We live in different neighborhoods. We're working different jobs, but we can find each other in times of crisis, in times of play, to learn from each other. You know, how do you crowdfund a film? Let me look at this person who just crowdfunded a film and see what they're doing. It's a great classroom. In fact, you know, the scary thing about social media to me as a writer is that I feel the same kind of flow when I'm on social media that I feel when I'm writing fiction. Mm. And that's sort of dangerous, but it speaks to the power of that sense of connection and community.
And speaking of community, that leads into the next question about Vona Voices.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's more visible now, but again, that can be because of social media has grown. Sure. So I hear more about it now. It's not just an ad in a magazine that I happen to be reading. So how long have you been involved with VONA? And for those who don't know what VONA Voices is, it is specifically a writer's conference that looks at various genres and also has residencies for writers of color, specifically writers of color. So
yes. VONA is great. I was approached by VONA, I think, in about 2009 to teach for the first time. Mm-hmm. I first co-taught with my husband, Stephen Barnes, who's also a great writing instructor. And since then, I've also been back several times as a solo instructor. They just started a speculative fiction track. So for the past two summers, I have taught nothing but speculative fiction writers of color, which has been a really interesting and fantastic experience. And just, you know, by way of background, VONA grew, and it was co-founded by DM Jones and Elmaz Abinader and Juno Diaz, and there's another board member, I know I'm forgetting, but it was co-founded because of this sense that writers of color were just getting sort of lost within the traditional MFA program system, where very often you're the only one in the room. This has been a conversation across the board. You're the only writer in the room in the comedy show. You're the only person of color at the board table. But, you know, but what happens when you're an artist and you're the only one in the room is that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, and I would even say often, there are elements of your work that are being under-scrutinized, over-scrutinized, misunderstood, in need of extra explanation, that really can delay the learning process, you know, because you know, sometimes writers feel isolated, sometimes writers feel attacked, and I think most often what happens is just sort of a benign neglect sometimes, and again, this is not always, and this is not everywhere. When I was at Northwestern University, I was in a mostly white creative writing program. I got great instruction and great mentorship from my instructors there. But you can also see sometimes an instructor will look at a student and sort of see him or herself reflected in that student and take them under their wing in a slightly different way because of that personal spark. So VONA is created to be a safe space, you know, for writers of color, and that means, you know, all different varieties of ethnicities to come together, and let's not stress out about the fact that some of this is not in English, you know. Let's pick up the context from the way it's used in the sentence, and let's not get too hung up over the use of the N-word in this context, and let's just talk about craft. Are these characters popping to life? Is this story moving me? And it really just cuts through so much, and it's almost a religious experience, I would say, for the writers who take part, because they've never been in this kind of environment, and they don't even realize sometimes what they weren't getting until they're in a workshop like VONA, when they can just sort of be free.
It's not just necessarily for potential debuts. Do you feel like there's also a sense of community that helps build those who are teaching as well?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, those instructors, those are some of the top-notch instructors, I would say, in the world, not just the country. You know, when you've got a Juno Diaz teaching a fiction class, Faith Adiele was doing a travel writing. She set up a program where her students could actually publish, you know. And for those of us as faculty members, I remember I was stuck once. I was working on Blood Colony, one of my African Immortals novels, and I was on deadline and stressed out. And, you know, just sometimes a simple question from a faculty member, what is your book about? Not what happens in your book. What is your book about? To make you sit and think and sort of hold you accountable to your own creative process and cut through your own BS is really valuable. We are there for the students, but I love and revel in the opportunity to interact even just socially with the other faculty members.
So let's get back to your upcoming collection, Ghost Summer Stories.
Yes.
With Prime Books.
Yes.
Due out September 1st, but you may be able to get a copy
a little
before
early.
That time.
A little early.
And it's in print and in ebook form, so people can get it online as well.
Yes.
And Ghost Summer, the titular story, is actually one of my favorite in the collection. I tend to favor, you know, from the younger perspective, and I love the whole adventure story and that there's so much going on, but the main thread is the ghost story. But there's, yeah, I don't want to ruin it for people. I don't want to say it too much, but the family dynamics, you know, the dad, the mom questioning, kind of growing up too soon in a way for the narrator in that story. So, I mean, they're all wonderful. That one stuck out for me as well.
I love to hear you talk about it, and thank you. And I'm glad it moved you. I think in a lot of ways, and that's a novella. That's the longest story in the piece. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, it really does encapsulate what I try to accomplish with my fiction. Mm-hmm. First, finding the personal family narrative that mirrors the supernatural dynamic in the story. Mm-hmm. So it's scary. It's scary to be a 12-year-old kid when you think your parents are going to get a divorce. So what does that fear feel like when you apply that to a supernatural element? And, you know, the story, just in a nutshell, is about a kid who's at that age where he's about to transition from what we consider kind of childhood to that tween, you know, adulthood. Mm-hmm. If he were Jewish, he'd be getting a bar mitzvah. You know, that coming of age when you start to perceive the world around you differently, and really for black boys, people start to treat you a little bit differently too.
Yes. Yeah.
You have to sort of choose your sides more, and it's a confusing time. So it's about a family trip for the summer to my little fictitious town of Gracetown. I started writing several stories based in this town where weird things happen over the summer. Mm-hmm. It was kind of my version of William Faulkner's Yaknapatawpha County. You know, it's a fictitious county where he likes to collect his characters, and that's what I started doing. I created this fictitious town, and I set several stories there, and Ghost Summer is the longest of those stories. So weird things happen over the summer. Children are most affected by the weird things. And he's a ghost hunter. He wants to train his little sister in being a ghost hunter. So there's that adventure part. But it turns out not to be so much fun, you know?
Exactly.
Because, you know, there's some real serious historical business trying to air itself mm-hmm. through this child. But also trying to point to a healing metaphor as well. I'm trying to accomplish a lot of things with that piece. And it really does encapsulate what a lot of my fiction is. I mean, whether you're talking about My Soul to Keep, that whole question of being in a relationship with someone you think you know, mm-hmm. and then it turns out you don't know them, well, that's real life, okay? A lot of us can relate to that. Mm-hmm. Where you add the supernatural, though, is that what you don't know is he's an immortal and he's 500 years old. And also using that story to talk about history in a broader sense, because as a 500-year-old, he's experienced slavery. Mm-hmm. And I really do, I try to adhere to this idea that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. I love history because we have to understand history to know why we are where we are. And to have some, you know, it's like a fixed point on a map and a continuum, you know, and you have to figure out, okay, where am I? Where do we start? Where are we headed?
Yeah.
And you can't know where you are or where you're headed until you know where you've come from. You're reliving the same battles over and over and over again. So that's really what I try to accomplish with my fiction. It's fun, maybe. It's a page turner, I hope. Mm-hmm. But at the core of the story, I really am trying to say something. Often even teach something and bring a little bit of peace, whether it's, gee, maybe death isn't such a bad thing, you know, if you're an immortal, you know?
Yeah.
Because at least I'm not going to live for 500 years and lose everybody in succession, you know, over and over and over again, which is the price for longevity. By the time you've reached a certain age, you are starting to lose everybody, you know? Some unfortunate people even outlive their children. So there are some things worse than dying, and et cetera. That's what I'm glad you liked that story.
Well, I also liked, I mean, I hope this is in the printed version as well. You do give those summaries of what inspired you to write that story or where that story came from. Sometimes it's a theme or just one element, you thought about loneliness, and that created this whole world for you. And for me, as an emerging writer, but also as a reader, it's great to see that kind of creative play for the author of how they interpreted that, and how, you know, sometimes the supernatural is a very big piece of the story, and sometimes it's a minor piece of the story. And at the heart, I'm a character person, so if you write characters, I'm with it. I'm with you from page one to the very end. And I think that's one of the biggest strengths of your work, is how in depth you look at characters. And that kind of leads me to my next question, because, you know, when people think of diversity, and some people don't like this word, you know, they're thinking about the issues. And in your work, you don't necessarily write about the issue, and I'm using quotes with my fingers when I say the issue of being a person of color, the issue of being a marginalized person. Your work is to connect people on a very emotional level. And that's not to say that there are commentary about race in some of these stories, and understandings of people feeling oppressed in certain ways. But do you feel that one of the reasons that there's not necessarily more embracing of diversity in the sci-fi fantasy genre is because of the fact that there can be a lack of separation in people's minds of race and culture in the larger story, or really that authors of the majority feel as though they want to steer away from the reality we live in terms of some issues, but not others?
You know, I think with all backlash, it's based in fear. And this is, you know, something we could talk about this very subject for 2 hours, what causes fear. You know, on one level, to be honest, when I first started writing, I looked at my name, Tanana Reeve Du, and I said, should I use a pen name? You know, is this going to be too much for people? There are people who will not pick up my book because of that name.
Really?
You know? And I'm sure, in fact, there are, frankly, people who don't, because they look at the name and they think, oh, that's too foreign. That's too, even a Black American reader might say that's too foreign. That's too exotic. I don't know if that's for me. And this is, by the way, not something that is confined to whites or people who are in the majority. I think there are a lot of us who could stand to read more Asian writers.
Absolutely.
More LGBT writers.
Absolutely.
You know, we do not tend to choose books that are not reflective of our own experiences. So that is a human problem. When you compound that human problem with a genre that has for many, many, many years been primarily, I almost use the term run by, like it's a company. It's not a company, but the work that has risen to public consciousness has often been white male straight writers, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a slow move to include more writers as they discover their own voices within that genre. I think, you know, for a lot of readers, they would never even think of reading science fiction, or they would not have even thought about reading science fiction if they had not found Octavia Butler. Mm-hmm. And then they find Octavia Butler, who's writing about characters of color, who's writing about issues of power dynamics and slavery, and that opens a whole world. It's like, oh, well, let me explore all these other writers, some of whom won't be Black, you know? And that's kind of how we all found our way. When I first started writing, there were very few Black writers who self-identified as horror writers or speculative fiction writers. You know, Clark Atlanta University invited a handful of us in 1998, or 1997, rather, and that was Octavia Butler, Chip Delaney, Stephen Barnes, Jewel Gomez, and me. And now, if you tried to fill a stage with Black writers of speculative fiction, you wouldn't have the room. Mm-hmm. That's just in this country. It's opening up worldwide. Mm-hmm. You know, there are magazines doing Chinese translations. So the world is waking up to speculative fiction, period. And that's a little scary to some people who are not used to those diverse voices. And of those who are most paranoid, David Gerald and I were just talking about that, it feels threatening. Mm-hmm. It's as if, this protagonist I have a transgender protagonist. What are you trying to say about me? You know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, well, wait, I'm not trying to say anything about you. It's just that my character happens to be different. That's not a statement about you. That's not some sort of a, you know, denouncement. It really, I think there are some readers who see difference as threats. because there must be some deeper message to this person being so different. And, you know, that's unfortunate. As the genres continue to grow and change, that will be less and less an issue. But, you know, it's a big wide world out there. And one of the things my mother told me when I was a kid that really helped during moments of isolation, if I was the only black kid in the class, was, you know, people of color around the world are the majority. So don't think that your experience here is indicative of what it's like out in the world. And that really, that perspective was so helpful for me. Just to feel a sense of belonging and pride, not superior to anybody, but just like, well, okay, fine. This is just how this looks in this classroom. But around the world, the brown skin is predominant.
Actually, Ken Liu mentioned that in a BookCon panel from a few months ago, that he's like, you know, in China, the Chinese are the majority. So this whole diversity thing is really a North American thing, or a United States of America thing.
Yes.
So speaking of that panel, one of your former students, a former guest on the podcast, Daniel Jose Older, who sings your praises every time he can get the chance. he was on the panel. Ken Liu was on the panel. Nnedi Okorafor was on the panel.
That was a powerful panel.
Yeah, Cameron Hurley was on the panel. And they jointly kind of said that writing can be a political act. And you said that for you earlier, it saved you. But do you also think, in a way, your stories reveal whether the subject matter comes close to home or not, something that's more about the social issues going on as well? Because, you know, there's the emotional that you tack on to, but what about the larger social issues? Do you feel like writing in general is something that should do that?
You know, I do. I don't think every writer is good at that necessarily. Mm-hmm. And in that case, and Juno Diaz, in fact, made a great argument at one of my Octavia Butler celebrations at Spelman last spring in 2014, you know, that you might have the most conservative writer out there write just an absolutely sublime short story with no intention, you know, of infusing it with politics. And you might have a more politically charged writer who's trying too hard, you know, and of course he says it much better than I can, and doesn't succeed so much on the level of art. You know, there's a balancing act between politics and art. And there's a quote, I have never been able to find out who said this, that the effect of politics and art is like a gunshot in an opera house, which I don't agree with, but I understand where the quote comes from. Because there's a way that it can become polemic. You know, it's no longer a story. It's no longer about the characters. It's all about the message. And I think that's what's so wonderful about Octavia Butler. Clearly, she writes with a strong sense of message, but she's also writing with a strong sense of biology and a strong sense of characterization. So it's not just the message. It's a message within the story. And for a writer for whom that doesn't come naturally, you know, I think it's just best to sort of write your bliss. I saw a quote from Samuel Delaney where he said he wasn't trying to change the world as an artist, you know. Now, it just so happened he was a pioneer in the 60s, you know, a black man writing science fiction in the 1960s and very young and writing a female protagonist in his novel, Babel 17, and all these sort of, and a black protagonist and another. So yes, he was a pioneer, but he was not writing about race directly. Not even as directly, or power dynamics, even as directly as Octavia. You know, he was doing his thing, and he became that sort of torchbearer for us all, even without trying to. Mm-hmm. So it depends artist by artist. You know, I'm writing a novel right now. I'm not allowed to talk about it too much because I promised myself I would shut up about talking about it until I had more work done. But it has a very strong social message at its base because it's about mass incarceration. Mm. You know, it's based on a family history story about a teenager, my mother's uncle, who died at a reformatory in Florida called the Dozier School, which has been very much in the news. If you Google Dozier in Florida, D-O-Z-I-E-R, all these horrific stories will come up of boys who died there. It was basically like a for-profit prison. I recently talked to a woman whose brother was sent there, and they got $50 for sending him there. Okay, so they would, and what would happen was they pay to have students sent there, and then they put them to work, child labor, you know, brick making and farming, and I mean, you name it. So it was a horrible, and we're headed there, okay? We're headed there. There were so many kids who died there. It had its own cemetery on grounds. They would send dogs after runaways. It was like slavery. So because of that situation, and it's difficult, I have to admit, one of my students recently said to me what they enjoyed about, this was one of my bonus students, about being in my class was that I had so much joy. I do not write well from anger. I don't think anger is what inspires my fiction. Maybe it's fear. I'll admit fear inspires my fiction. That's why I write horror. But I do mostly thrive in a more joyful place. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, even the research for this novel has been incredibly difficult. I cry when I try to read the nonfiction accounts, and it's hard to motivate yourself. Mm-hmm. So I end up writing a lot of other things that are not this novel because it's more fun. But every time I start to stray away from it, there's a new story. There's a Sandra Bland. Next week's hashtag. You know, I'm on TweetDeck all the time looking for the next hashtag, the next story that we cannot let get overlooked and buried. And even with as many hashtags as we've had so far, there are so many other stories that just don't get the same traction because they're from an even more underrepresented community, like the Native Americans, who are also battling a terrible problem with police brutality. Mm-hmm. They're the second most likely group to die at the hands of police, from what I understand. You know, I'm looking for that. And so this novel is my way, hopefully, of bringing more attention and light to this mass incarceration problem that starts in the schools, the school to prison pipeline, goes to street level policing. I want to try to encapsulate all of that in a piece of fiction that is entertaining on one level to read, but also has a message underneath. Not everything I write has that same strong social message directly. Mm-hmm. There's also this very human problem we deal with that is mortality. And I would have to say that even more than race, it is this question of mortality that drives my fiction.
Mm. And this mortality is a very scary thing.
It is a scary thing, and it's scarier terrible. As you get older and you start to experience more of it up close. It kind of seems like a far-off idea for a while. And then, like, for instance, I recently lost my mother, you know, in February of 2012. And that, and we were there at her bedside singing around her bed as she drew her last breath. And when you watch that life go, it's a very different experience than just imagining it.
Yes.
From a distance.
Yes.
And I have always sought to find ways to order all of these emotions, these fears, the grief of loss. A lot of ways that's what drove Dawit's personality in My Soul to Keep is that he had been altered by his losses, and these immortals had to come up with all kinds of sort of emotional firewalls to keep from experiencing loss and grief over and over again. You know, you can't hang out with mortals, you must be with your own, no one must know, no one must join, and all this, and even that's not enough to keep loss from touching you.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is something that affects all of us, you know, it affects us as blacks, it affects us if we're not black, so that does drive a lot of my fiction, but within that, of course, raised by civil rights activists, you know, my mother spent 49 days in jail in Tallahassee, Florida, for sitting in at a Woolworth lunch counter. She was Patricia Stevens Dew. My father, John Dew, is still living. He's still fighting the fight. He's a civil rights lawyer. He's off to meetings every day, still fighting the fight. That is a part of who I am. Maybe because I went to too many meetings as a child, I can't really do so many meetings now. But I was always given the freedom by my parents to be an artist. They never looked at that askance. They never looked down upon it. In fact, my mother told me, you know, in the 60s, the NAACP put a lot of emphasis on that Beverly Hills Hollywood branch because they knew the impact of images in the movement.
Yes.
So artists have a place in the movement. And to go back to your original question, is it a political act just to write? Yes. So what my husband and I were just having this conversation. We were coming up with a little short movie idea starring a black female protagonist. And we were wondering, should we add a little slavery here or there? It's like, you know, the fact that she's black in a science fiction movie speaks for itself.
Okay. And doesn't die in the first 5 minutes, that's...
It's already political. Because this is a black woman's story. That in itself is political.
Mm-hmm. So would that be, as a last question, would that be kind of the advice you'd give to writers of color? Especially a lot of the listeners tend to be those in the industry, as well as emerging artists of color who are, they're feeling a bit downtrodden. And maybe you've seen it. Being teaching at Vona, teaching in general, seeing, working with these artists and just feeling like their voices don't matter. And hearing from you, it's like you have something to say.
You know, you really, first as an artist, have to be true to your own voice. This is, and that voice may not be a political voice. So if your best writing comes from a place that is not political, do your best writing. And then give to political organizations or go to marches for your politics, you know. Mm-hmm. I really believe that. I believe that activism takes many forms. Some people can be more political in their writing. That's what drives them, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what excites them. Embrace that, you know, especially in Hollywood, somewhat in publishing, although this is changing. But in Hollywood, there's often this idea that if you write it, quote, race neutral, you'll have a better chance of success. A, in publishing, I don't think that's true at all anymore. I mean, look at Daniel Jose Older's cover for his latest novel, Shadow Shaper. I mean, it's, you know, this woman with this beautiful natural hair, and it's a phenomenon. I looked at my book covers for a couple of books we did for young adults saying, why didn't we go in this direction? You know, it's like, because now it's sort of taking off. Even in Hollywood, though, where admittedly it's a harder battle. I, when's the last time you saw a black legal thriller, okay? I mean, we don't even have to go to speculative fiction. It's just it's just hard to find characters of color just sort of living the different colors of the rainbow outside of a certain kind of genre. You know, comedy, okay. Crime, okay. But still, we're fighting that battle. Mm-hmm. But here's the deal. If you try to write race neutral, but that's not where your heart is, you're not going to do your best writing. Mm-hmm. So you have to find that story you want to tell. If that's the story of your grandmother in Louisiana in the 1930s, yeah, that's going to be a hard sell. But write it anyway. Mm-hmm. Write it anyway, because that's your heart. And then when you write that, move on to the next thing, you know, that may be a little more commercial because it's not a historical or, you know, whatever the reasons. But if you're swayed too much by what you think will sell, you could write yourself into a corner.
Yeah.
There's a Venn diagram I like to use when I'm teaching, these overlapping circles. You know, one circle represents those things that are selling. You know, you can look at the bestseller list. Oh, this is big, this is big, this is big. Mm-hmm. The other circle is what you want to write. What are your stories? Where's your heart? Now, you move those two circles together, and where they overlap in the center, that's what you should write. Something that you actually want to write, but that also might have a commercial life.
Yeah.
And I say might, because trying to predict what would be a bestseller is kind of a foolish game. Absolutely. Nobody knows. If publishing knew what would be a bestseller, everybody would be writing bestsellers. When the late, great Elin Harris started writing his novels about black bisexual men, there was no market for that.
Mm-hmm.
He started writing that because that was his story. And I think and Terry McMillan, you know, she didn't have any reason to believe there was a market in traditional publishing. She self-published. Elin Harris self-published. They showed publishing what would sell. The same would be true in television with Shonda Rhimes. She showed television that black people will watch TV. Mm-hmm. And because of people like Shonda Rhimes, and we have it also with Empire, let me tell you, the face of television is going to be very different in the next 3 years. It already is, but it's not going to stop. It's not a trend, because the numbers are the numbers. These people wouldn't be putting this stuff on TV and recasting black if they didn't know what those numbers are. We have the numbers. So what are we going to do with the numbers? This is the best time ever to be an artist of color. Just hands down.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, it's an uphill battle. Yes, there's still a lot of ignorance. Yes, there is resistance. But if you have a story to write, there has never been a better time to get it out there, because if you can't find a publisher, you can publish it yourself. If you can't get Hollywood to make it, you can crowdfund it yourself. And none of that is easy, but those are options that were not available just a few years ago.
Yeah.
For a lot of people.
Yeah. So thank you, Tanana Reeves, so much for being on the podcast.
And well, thank you for having me.
How can people reach out to you? How can people find you and your work, more importantly?
Well, I am on Twitter at Tanana Reeves Du. If you have to spell the name, it's like Tanana with a banana, like banana, R-I-V-E, Tanana Reeves, and then Du is all one word. I'm on Facebook. My books are generally, actually all my books are still in print. I'm very blessed in that way. I think the civil rights memoir I wrote with my mother, Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights, is print on demand, but it's still available. It's available as an ebook. So I'm very blessed. I've been in the business a long time. I started publishing in 1995. So I have a large backlist. And a lot of people are discovering me anew because I'm writing short stories. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I did a short story collection. Over 15 years, I finally wrote enough short stories that I had enough to put in one book. But there are so many writers who've never heard of me, but they see my short story in a Lightspeed magazine or whatever, lightspeed.com, and they're like, oh, let me check her out. So I feel very blessed as a writer, and I'm super excited to see how the field, the publishing field in particular, but also in Hollywood, it's just growing to make room for so many new artists. There's no one writer who can, you know, scratch everybody's itch for the supernatural or scratch everybody's itch for science fiction. You can only write so fast.
Yeah.
So I'm thrilled that Daniel Jose Older is out there, and N.K. Jemisin is out there, and Nnedi Okorafor is out there, and Nalo Hopkinson is out there, and Stephen Barnes is out there, and all these just new voices and new writers changing the conversation. And some of them, like Brie Newsom, who is also a horror filmmaker.
Yes.
Before she climbed up and took down that Confederate flag in Charleston, she was a horror filmmaker. People who are literally changing the world.
And now you guys know of Tanana Reeves Du if you didn't. And Ghost Summer, again, Ghost Summer Stories, comes out officially September 1st. Prime Books in paperback, is it? Paperback?
Yes, it's a trade paperback and an ebook.
And an ebook. So I would say go to your indie, ask for it if they don't have it, or go to an indie bookstore. And it's available on Amazon, but I'd like to support the indies if we can do it. Or buy it directly from Prime Books. It's on the website.
There you go.